Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Iraq and the prospect of all-out civil war. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After the worst sectarian violence since the U.S. invasion, a daytime curfew has been lifted in Iraq. The streets of Baghdad and other cities are quiet by current standards, but powerful tensions remain. On To The Point, Iraqi security forces are on high alert, but they've been infiltrated by Shiite militias. Sunnis want militias of their own. Are political leaders or religious clerics really in charge? Will conflicts that date to the 8th century lead to a civil war that could spread from Iraq to the rest of the Middle East? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the Dubai deal and port security. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. The streets of Iraq have calmed down for the moment, but security forces are infiltrated by Shiite militias, and Sunnis now want private armies of their own. On To The Point, despite the efforts of politicians urged on by the United States, Iraq still faces the prospect of all-out civil war. We'll look at the roots of sectarian hostilities and the potential for violence spreading throughout the Middle East. On Reporter's Notebook, we'll talk with former Democratic Senator and security expert Gary Hart about the Dubai port management deal. First, this news update. The European Union has announced plans to save the Palestinian Authority from immediate financial collapse. That's despite the takeover of the parliament by Hamas. The EU will come up with $140 million for what it calls basic needs for the next 2 months. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem correspondent for the Financial Times. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Pleasure.
What are basic needs?
Basic needs, as defined by the EU when they granted this money today, involves a certain amount of money going to the refugee agency of the United Nations, UNRWA. That will go for health and educational programs. Other parts of the cash will go to pay salaries for Palestinian Authority employees, which is a main way in which the donor community inject money into the Palestinian economy month by month.
Does that include the salaries for security forces?
Well, it does. At the moment, the Palestinian Authority, even with this money, may still be pressed to pay all the salaries for the coming month. But it does include about 70,000 security forces, which is 50% of about 140,000 public employees.
What happens after the 2 months are over?
Well, that's a good question. This is very much a stopgap measure, and it follows on from the decision by the Quartet, which is the United States and the Europeans, the Russians and the United Nations, to keep the economy going until such time as there is a Hamas government, and that could be as much as a month away.
What about Mahmoud Abbas, the elected president of the Palestinian Authority, of course a member not of Hamas but of Fatah?
Well, at the moment, the American administration and certainly most of the European countries seem to want to reinforce Mahmoud Abbas because he is the one who theoretically is in charge with negotiations with Israel. Negotiations with the Hamas government obviously are not possible at the present time. But the Israelis have a rather different outlook on it, and it's not totally coherent at the moment. For instance, at the weekend, the foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, described Mr. Abbas as irrelevant to the process. Now, that is not a view shared throughout the present government, but it is the view of the hardliners.
Now, of course, the new prime minister of the Palestinian Authority has also called Mr. Abbas irrelevant.
Yes, up to a point. But, I mean, the relationship so far between the Hamas leadership and Mr. Abbas has been fairly correct. There may be fights ahead, but they haven't actually been fighting so far.
Talking with Harvey Morris, the Jerusalem correspondent for the Financial Times, well, you indicated that even with this money, the authority is still going to be pressed to pay everybody. If, in fact, there appear to be economic shortages going on, is Hamas concerned that now that it's in charge, it will be blamed?
I think they are concerned. They're displaying a great deal of bravado at the moment and saying that if there is economic hardship, the Palestinians will know to blame Israel and the rest of the world rather than to blame Hamas. But I think in reality, they do realize that they're facing a serious crisis. But they have already made this point in advance that everyone else is to blame but them.
What about this two-month period and its relationship to the Israeli election?
Well, I think that the idea of certainly of the Europeans and possibly also the U.S. administration, it was to sort of freeze things as they are at the moment, continue with some aid until such time as a Hamas government comes into power. And by that time, there would have been the Israeli elections, and it would have taken this whole issue out of the Israeli election campaign, where, of course, all the leading candidates are very keen not to be seen as soft on Hamas.
So the EU is buying time, then, for the moment?
I think so, yeah, but it's not very much time, actually.
How is the is Hamas doing in terms of forming a new government?
They're taking it very, very slowly. Initially, they said that the process might take 2 to 3 weeks. It's looking more and more as if they will stretch out the process as long as they can. So it's still not clear whether they're going to be choosing predominantly ministers from Hamas or whether they will choose technocrats as the existing government is.
And very quickly, what's the advantage to Hamas from stretching it out?
I think, and maybe even on the aid issue, at least they've got some money coming in for the time being. They do get the Israeli elections out of the way, perhaps. Maybe they're as keen as everyone else to see them over. And they think that perhaps the scenario might be somewhat calmer after that period.
Harvey Morris, thanks a lot for being with us.
Pleasure.
Jerusalem correspondent for the Financial Times. In a moment, Iraq and the continuing prospect of civil war on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point. After last week saw the worst sectarian violence since the U.S. invasion, talks on forming a unity government in Iraq broke down. Over the weekend, the streets were calmer. Shiites and Sunnis said the talks might resume if the streets stayed quiet. Today, the daytime curfew was lifted, with Iraqi troops remaining on high alert, and the Sunni Consensus Front said it will return to the negotiations. That's according to Ed Wong, who is in Baghdad for the New York Times. Ed, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Describe, first of all, the situation on the streets with the curfew lifted. How did it go?
Well, we drove through the city today into some neighborhoods in western Baghdad, I think, where a lot of the violence had taken place, and it was pretty quiet. I mean, lots of people going about their daily lives, shopping, lots of gridlock on the streets because it was the first time people had been able to travel in vehicles in several days, and I think there were lots of people just going out, getting basic foods and getting cooking fuel and filling up their gas tanks. A lot of people we talked to sitting in cafes out on the sidewalk, they also said that there was still a sense of unease, a sense of tension, and that a suspicion of what might happen next.
What are the prospects of getting the talks on the unity government back on track?
Right now, it seems like all the parties basically want to get those talks started. One person who's a Sunni negotiator told us that basically the Sunnis are ready to come back. There's good talks going on with the conservative Shiites in terms of forming the mechanism for the negotiations. Basically, the parties all have to agree on like the mechanism by which they will negotiate to form the government. And then they're also waiting to see whether the violence stays at a low level. And as long as that's that happens, and as long as sectarian tensions remain calm, then I think they'll go back to talk sometime soon.
We're talking with Edward Wong at the New York Times in Baghdad. You have written that there is much concern about the extent to which the Shiite militias have infiltrated the Iraqi security forces. Can you elaborate a bit on that, and to what extent is that now playing a part in the talks and in the effort to get a unity government together?
Well, that's actually one of the biggest sticking points that will come about in forming government. Basically, the Sunnis are very much concerned about giving control of the Interior Ministry, which controls the police and commando units, back to the Shiites, who currently have control of it. The Americans have also been pushing for the religious Shiites to give that up. They basically want a non-sectarian, non-religious leader in the Ministry of Interior who basically will not favor Sunnis or Shiites. And the Shiites have resisted. Last week during the violence, you heard one of the Shiite leaders basically lashing out at the American ambassador for suggesting that the Shiites should give up control of the ministry. And one of the Shiite militia heads told us in an interview over the weekend that the Shiites would never let the ministry go. So I think we're going to see a lot of conflict over that. And I think that the violence only reinforced the notion by the Sunnis that they must get the Shiites out of there, because what happened during the violence was that in a lot of places the police stood by and watched as Shiite militiamen attacked some of these mosques. And I think that that basically underscored for the Sunnis how dangerous it is to keep the Shiites or the religious Shiites in the police force.
Does it appear that since all of the talk about civil war last week, while this sectarian violence seemed to be at its height, has in fact had an impact on the leaders involved, both political and religious?
I do think it has had an impact. It's sort of like the cliched phrase that people use, that they stared into this and they wanted to back away from it. And that's essentially what happened, in our opinion, from talking to some of the leaders, is that they realized on all sides that, one, they didn't want a bloodbath here in Iraq, and that if something like that did take place, then it would spiral out of control and it'd be hard for them to come out, for any side to come out a victor in that. The other thing was that each side realized that they had something to gain by trying to resolve things politically, because they were more motivated than ever to, I guess, in a sense, make political gains so that they could strengthen their positions if something like this ever did happen again. Like I was saying, for example, the Sunnis realized that they should get involved in forming governments so that they could try and keep the Shiites from dominating the security forces so thoroughly.
You've mentioned that Ambassador Khalilzad had been verbally attacked by the Shiites. How much power right now does the United States appear to have?
Well, the U.S. has been playing sort of a mediation role so far in the talks. And last week, we did hear Khalilzad come out and try and basically suggested a way in which the U.S. might wield leverage, which is basically, he said that the U.S. people might not continue putting financial resources into security forces that were sectarian-based. And that was basically a suggested threat in a way, saying that if the religious Shiites didn't back down from the ministry, then the U.S. might not support the forces any longer. I don't know if the U.S. would actually follow through on it. He could have been bluffing, but the fact is that he was trying to show that the U.S. does have leverage, financial leverage, military leverage, because I think the government still needs U.S. support to try and push back on the insurgency. So the U.S. does still have a lot of leverage here.
Edward Wong, staff writer for the New York Times in Baghdad. Listening to our conversation is Jeff Beals. He is a diplomat and political advisor at the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, and he's involved in the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Iraqi political and religious leaders. Mr. Beals, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Anything you'd like to add to what we just heard from Ed Wong?
No, I think that Ed's put it pretty accurately. I mean, but I would add to it that part of what the U.S. has here and what we can use in these talks isn't just the leverage of military might or the pocketbook. It's the fact that we have been turned to increasingly as the trusted side between a lot of actors that previously sort of distrusted us or maybe even outright fought us. And that's been something that's actually been a development that's allowed us to help act as a broker in a way that's brought people together and expanded the government's base of support at a time when it might have been facing a major crisis without any Sunni Arab leaders in their midst.
We've heard a lot of criticism from both sides of the U.S. and its role there. At what point did it become trusted by both sides?
It's been a long-term process. Part of it's negative because part of it is they have seen some sectarianism in their own forces and have learned from the conduct of U.S. soldiers that they don't have a dog in the fight other than to provide security for the Iraqis and make sure that the country is stable. So that's helped. Another part of it is that we've increasingly taken a role in trying to actively shape the way the Iraqis come together and sort of play the father role that America was playing all along here in trying to bring a democracy to light.
If the U.S. has no dog in the fight, as you put it, let's assume for the moment that there might be an outbreak of civil war, however that might be different from what is going on now. Would the U.S. under those circumstances have any choice except to withdraw?
Well, I don't really accept that premise. I mean, the fact of the matter is what's been going on here right now, while it did indeed push Iraq into perilous waters, was nevertheless extremists on both sides sort of firing over the heads of a lot of shocked and stunned moderates who were didn't know how to deal with a major attack that had frankly caught them by surprise, despite the amount of violence that happens in Iraq. And since then, there's been a lot of rallying by the center in Iraq, which is a lot wider than the people who actually want to engage in a sectarian conflict, and I think they're helping avert it.
So by the surprise attack, you're referring to the attack on the Golden Mosque in Samarra, the much-revered Shiite shrine, which was virtually destroyed and then led to the attacks on Sunni mosques around the country.
Right.
Again, Jeff Beals is diplomat, political advisor to the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. Juan Coles, professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the History Department at the University of Michigan. He also publishes juancoles.com, a web log on the Middle East, on history, on Islam and religion, much consulted in recent years. And Juan Coles, always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
What do you say to what we just heard from Jeff Beals, that the United States now is trusted by both sides? Its position as a broker is much strengthened.
Well, I certainly think it's the case that whereas earlier on there were Sunni Arabs who would have not been willing to deal with the U.S., even meet with them, especially among the more religious parties, that some of those I think now are willing to and see the United States as an offset to the growing power of the Shiite fundamentalists and the Kurds. But I guess I'm not very happy with us focusing only on those big politicians who are meeting in the green zone. I don't think they really represent very many people, and I don't think what happens in parliamentary negotiations has a big relevance to most of the country.
What does have relevance to most of the country?
Well, you know, it's like Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. You know, Baghdad is being starved of fuel and electricity by the guerrillas who have a concerted policy of hitting pipelines and attacking truck convoys to keep it from having proper fuel and electricity. An incident like we saw last week where guerrillas very sort of with fiendish cleverness attacked a symbol of the Shiites and drove crowds into frenzy, and it wasn't just a few radicals. This was a mass outburst. There was anger everywhere in the street, and there are more shrines in Iraq that can be hit. There are more symbols. God forbid someone could assassinate Grand Ayatollah Sistani, which would throw the country completely into chaos. So I don't think there's any reason to be sanguine, and I don't believe that the big politicians who give the speeches and who are engaged in these negotiations and come before the cameras really have that much ability to control things if they get out of hand.
Should the U.S. then be talking more to the religious leaders?
Well, they are talking to the religious leaders, and indeed the religious leaders have won the December 15th elections. What I'm saying is that with the dissolution of the Ba'ath Party, there isn't any sort of nationwide party apparatus. There isn't any organization in Iraq where some leader could give an order and be sure that it was obeyed out in the hinterlands. So what I'm saying is that this thing is out of control. There's not an early prospect of getting it under control. I respect very much the efforts being made by the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad to broker settlements and to make negotiations. I'm just saying I'm worried it's not enough.
Do you think there's going to be, or that I believe you've already said on this program and elsewhere, that you think there already is a civil war? Are you concerned about what others refer to as an all-out a civil war and what that might mean?
Yeah, it's a low-intensity or unconventional civil war at the moment, although it went to a pretty high status last week when you had hundreds of killed per day and mosques burned down and attacked and taken over. So I just think that this is a kind of situation where over time more and more feuds emerge, more and more raw feelings are there. There might not have been this level of violence the year before or the year before that. You know, the religious Shiite procession of Ashura was attacked in spring of 2004, and it didn't provoke this kind of massive violence. So I see the situation as spiraling downward, and I don't see what puts the brakes on it. I mean, it's all very well for the community leaders to come out and talk about unity. The other thing to remember is that a lot of Iraqis blame the United States the United States and Israel, is what was said, for the explosion at the Golden Shrine. And Muqtada Sadr, one of the key street leaders, continues to say this. And he's now saying there should be demonstrations and mosque services of unity between Sunni and Shiites, one purpose of which would be to call for an immediate U.S. withdrawal.
Juan Cole, again, professor of modern Middle East history and at the University of Michigan. Back to Jeff Beals. I don't think that you said earlier that you were sanguine about the situation in Iraq, but what do you say to Professor Cole's characterization of it as spiraling down with no breaks in sight?
I would say that I think he's definitely identifying a lot of negative things that are going on here, but it's, in my opinion, a moment of peril and possibility, because if you look a year ago, there's two differences today. One of them is a negative difference. One of them is that there is an increasing sectarian tone to this conflict, and that has really risen during the term of this interim government because it's a government that's been dominated by Shia and Kurds.
I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We'll come back after a very brief break, let you make the second part of your point. Again, Jeff Beals is a diplomat and political advisor to the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. We'll continue our conversation with him, Juan Cole, and others on Reporter's Notebook. Former U.S. Senator Gary Hart, who chaired the U.S. Commission on National Security, talks about the Dubai ports deal. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Talk today about the situation in Iraq. Just heard Juan Cole, professor at the University of Michigan, say he thinks that the things are spiraling down with no breaks in sight to be put on them. Jeff Beals, our diplomat, political advisor at the U.S. Embassy, who's a part of the ongoing negotiations between the U.S. and the Iraqi political and religious leaders, said, yes, there have been problems, there have been perils, the sectarian violence certainly being one of them. But, Jeff Beals, you also said there are many, there's possibilities in all of this. Let me let you finish your point.
Well, the other part of the point was that if you look a year ago to today, you definitely see more sectarianism today than you saw a year ago. But the other thing you see today that you didn't see a year ago is the widespread participation in the political process. We ran an election a year ago that was almost completely boycotted by the Sunni Arab community in Iraq. A province like Al-Anbar, which is completely dominated by Sunni Arabs, saw almost no participation in the elections at all.
We ran another election in December, and we saw a province like Anbar, where we actually have limited control ourselves of the military, dominated by Sunni Arabs, and you got about 95% participation in the elections. So there's the building blocks are there now to have a government that can actually claim legitimacy from all parts of the Iraqi population, and that just wasn't around before. So that's a really significant change, and the question is whether or not you can build on it.
Again, Jeff Beals, diplomat and advisor to the U.S. Embassy. Earlier, Professor Cole mentioned that Muqtada al-Sadr, one of the Shiite leaders in Iraq, had blamed both the United States and Israel for the bombing of the Shiite mosque. Another person who did that is the current president of Iran, Mr. Ahmadinejad. Mansour Farhang is with us. He's professor of political science at Bennington College in Vermont, but he was Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations after the revolution in 1979 and 1980. And Mansour Farhang, always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
How concerned do you think Iran is about about there being a civil war in Iraq? Is that something that Iran would like to see?
But Iran, like other neighbors of Iraq, is very fearful of the expansion of the communal violence in Iraq because it could force Iran into an unwanted violent confrontation, conflict, involve Iran in the civil war that can only be hurtful to Iran, both politically and economically. And in this sense, Iran's concern is virtually identical with that of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan, and Turkey. They are concerned and fearful because U.S. policy in Iraq, however inadvertently, even though some people in the region believe advertently, has transformed Iraq into a country where power is so dispersed along ethnic, regional, even neighborhood lines that there is very little credible national authority, and the religious leaders who continue to have influence over the populace, they seem to be growing into warlords. Therefore, the influence of Iran, which is largely through well-known Shi'i leaders, centers in Baghdad or in Basra, is diminishing to this widespread dispersion of power, a kind of chaotic situation or Lebanization of Iraq, that it deeply concerns Iran. So the idea that, as Mr. Khalilzad seems to imply, that Iran is contributing to the chaos in Iraq is absolutely false. There is no evidence that Iran wants to see the civil war expand because logically and empirically there is nothing to be gained for Iran in this situation.
Why would Iran, as you said, have to become involved? Why would it be forced to do that?
Iran is the only predominantly Shi'i country in the region, and if there is a Shi'i-Sunni civil war in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other United Arab Emirates, Jordan, and others will inevitably help the Sunnis, particularly the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia are not going to stand by and see the Sunnis being decimated, who happen to be the minority in Iraq, by the Shi'is, who are definitely getting assistance from Iran. And Iran, having 700 kilometers of common border with Iraq, having a close relationship with the Iraqi leaders over the past 25 years, has been and will continue to be involved, except that the involvement could be political, influence-seeking, or military. Therefore, it is not something that Iran or Saudi Arabia or Turkey or the rest want, but if the civil war expands, it is very hard to imagine how they could refuse some involvement.
Mansour Farhang, again, former ambassador to the United Nations from Iran, now professor at Bennington College in Vermont. Rami Khoury is back with us today. He's editor-at-large of the Daily Star in Beirut, English-language newspaper distributed throughout the Arab world. And Rami Khoury, good to have you back.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
My understanding is that when Secretary Rice recently met with some of the Arab leaders in countries that Ambassador Farhang just referred to, they told her pretty much the same thing he said, that they're very concerned about the possible spread of Shiite and Sunni violence. Do you take that to be true?
Oh, I think it's true. It's not something that they're concerned about happening in the future. It's already been happening partly as a direct consequence of the American war, the invasion and overthrow of the regime in Iraq, and partly because of other disequilibria and distortions and problems that have plagued the region for many years. But when you introduce 160,000 American troops and you overthrow a regime and you try to do political genetic engineering and reshape the whole system within an electoral timetable that is more suited to Washington than to the realities of the Middle East, ignoring 5,000 years of history here, you get these kinds of things happening. I mean, there's a real sense that the tensions and the violence and the vulnerabilities that have been unleashed in Iraq are starting to have an impact on many other countries in the region, directly or indirectly. And it's not just a question of this Shia crescent that some people have talked about. That certainly is an issue that many people are concerned about, particularly because what you're seeing is a challenge to the tradition of Sunni dominance and often minority Sunni dominance. But you have bigger problems. I think the real unspoken issue, which nobody really dares to talk about, is that what Iraq is showing is that most of the Arab countries have frailties and vulnerabilities that are due to historic artificialities, and these are being exposed. So there's real concern all over the region.
Elaborate a little bit on what you said earlier, that you think already there are shadows or echoes of the sectarian violence in Iraq in other parts of the Middle East.
Well, I think if you go back over the last, say, I don't know, maybe 10 years, maybe a bit more, a bit less, I think those of us who live here in the Middle East have recognized something in the last couple of years, especially since the invasion of Iraq by the U.S.-led troops. You know, we rarely, and you probably noticed this if you do a content analysis of your own shows over the last year, you probably noticed that the unit of analysis that we use now to talk about most countries in the Middle East is increasingly less the state, the country, and increasingly more the subnational groups. We talk of Shias and Sunnis and Kurds and Alawites and Maronites and Copts and Druze and Armenians and Orthodox. And so, you know, what's happened is that people have started to look at the subnational groups as the real units that matter, because in many cases, those are the real units that matter to their own people. There is a vulnerability and a frailty and a slight incoherence to many of the existing countries in the Arab world particularly. And this has been, I think, accentuated and aggravated by what's going on in Iraq. And the Americans are partly to blame, not just because of the invasion, but the way that they've gone around trying to do political reengineering in Iraq is deliberately using the minority groups. And they talk about Sunnis and Shias and Kurds. That's all you hear in the American press. So I think there's a real problem here, and it's partly a historic problem of the modern Arab world. It goes back to the creation of most of the Arab countries at the hand of European statescraft. And the, you know, sort of post-colonial and what some of us would call neo-colonial statecraft. And partly it's been aggravated by the incompetence of most of the regimes in this region and their undemocratic in nature and abuse of power over the last four or five decades. And partly it's due to the re-entry of American military forces in a big way in the last few years. So there's a lot of blame to go around. The Arab-Israeli conflict, of course, didn't help things either. Israel's fingers are in the pie here and there. So there's a lot of blame to go around. It's not the problem of any one person, but I think the people of the region are trying to look at these issues more carefully and find out, well, what is the antidote to all these problems? And democracy, obviously, is one of them, if it is defined and implemented by its own people. And more clear national identities is another one.
Rami Khoury, again, at the Daily Star in Beirut. I want to go back to Jeff Beals, again, advisor to the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. Your comment, if you will, on what Rami Khoury just said about the United States deliberately manipulating the ethnic differences in Iraq. I suppose the question would be, first, is that going on? Secondly, is there any choice?
Well, I think actually he made some really interesting points, and the final point that he made was maybe the most revealing of all, which is there's something fundamentally broken in this system and going back a long way historically, and that the answers to it, while difficult to find, probably lie in democracy and finding a way to get these systems to be be structured in a way that actually respects the needs of the different populations within it. So I think the U.S. right now is less trying to play ethnic groups off of one another and more trying to find a system in which they can actually coexist, because what you had in Iraq before we came here was merely the brutal suppression of all remaining groups by one. And now the idea is whether or not you can harness a system like federalism to bring together some people that were maybe artificially tacked together when the lines were drawn by Winston Churchill and Gertrude Bell, and create a system that actually allows them to coexist while at the same time retaining some measure of autonomy.
Again, Jeff Beals is at the U.S. Embassy in Iraq. Juan Cole, back to you, Professor of Modern Middle East History at the University of Michigan. A two-minute history, if you will, of how the Western powers, Churchill, of course, Winston Churchill being a part of it all, basically drew the boundaries we're dealing with now.
Well, there's a sense in which, of course, Britain midwifed modern Iraq. It conquered Iraq during World War I. The British troops were trying to go up and meet up with the Russians in the north, who were fighting the Ottomans, and that's how the British got all the way up past Mosul into the Kurdish regions. And then when the war was over, they tried to cobble the whole thing together as a state. It didn't have a centralized, bureaucracy for that whole country, although the three major provinces that constituted what is now Iraq under the Ottoman Empire did have some unity, and Basra and Mosul reported to Baghdad, which then reported to Istanbul. So it's not a complete innovation that these areas are linked, but it is a new thing to have a state there. And the British brought in a Sunni monarchy from Western Arabia that didn't really have anything to do with Iraq. That Sunni monarchy depended heavily on local Sunni Arabs who had been high in the Ottoman administration and who, under the change in laws, grabbed up a lot of land and became big landowners. Iraq was made into a huge hacienda for essentially the Sunni Arab minority elite, which provoked a lot of social tension, and that's what caused the overthrow of the monarchy in 1958, the military coup, and then the rise of the Ba'ath. The Ba'ath was not initially a vehicle for Sunni Arab dominance. It was a vehicle for social justice, and 50% of the sort of middle managers and lower-level positions in the Ba'ath Party were held by Shiites. But in the Saddam period in particular, he used it as a kind of vehicle for a Sunni Arab clique that did end up marginalizing the Kurds and the Shiites, and marginalizing is a weak word, okay, and committing genocide against them.
Juan Cole, again, at the University of Michigan. Mansour Farhang, back to you, the former ambassador from Iran. If, in fact, as everyone seems to agree, what's really of concern to the people in the Middle East are less the national boundaries than they are the religious and ethnic differences. How far back do they go?
But in which country? Each country has its own, history. It's very difficult to generalize. Iran, for example, never really had colonial experience, and Iranian boundaries existed before the colonial powers began interfering or influencing Iranian politics. But today, I would say, beginning with the Iran-Iraq war, the sense of affinity between Iranians and the Iraqi Shiis has been politicized. And the politicization came to a peak when the United States invaded Iraq. And here, there was a convergence of interest between the ideologues, the right-wing ideologues in Washington, as well as exiles and ideologues cooked up the idea of transforming Iraq into a utopian conservative democracy, but it coincided exactly with what Iran wanted: destruction of the Saddam Hussein's army and expansion of the Shi'i influence in Iraq. So the sense of affinity that exists between the two is largely the product of Iranian assistance to the Iraqi Shi'is for a period of 20 to 25 years, and Iraqis feel indebted, as well as a sense of cultural and religious affinity they have with Iranians. So whatever happens in the future, at least the southern part of Iraq will be under the influence of the Shi'is, and the Iranian and Iraqi alliance will definitely be strengthened. It might not reach Baghdad or the western part of Iraq, or definitely not Kurdistan. So overall, if there is no civil war in Iraq, and if Iran is not going to be involved in a civil war situation, the U.S. invasion of Iraq has been a gift to Iranian foreign policy agenda.
Mansour Farhang, the former Iranian ambassador to the United Nations. Juan Cole, over the weekend, Ted Koppel, the former anchor of Nightline on ABC, a very well-regarded journalist in this country, said, why don't we talk about what this is really about from the United States standpoint, what President Carter said as he was leaving office, that the United States will never allow the Strait of Hormuz to be closed, that what it's really all about, according to Ted Koppel, is oil?
Well, it certainly, in some part, was about oil, although that hasn't worked out very well. You'll notice that the price of petroleum has nearly tripled since the war began. So I'm not sure the goal has been achieved here. If the idea was to open up Iraq to oil exploration and increase Iraqi production, I think we're years away from that happening.
Let me get back to the Middle Eastern point of view. Rami Khoury, back to you at the Daily Star in Beirut. Do many people in the Middle East believe that it is, from the United States point of view, all about oil?
I think there's a very large segment of the Arab population, and we know this from public opinion polling, that believes that what the U.S. is doing is basically to do three things. One, oil. Two, help Israel. And three, weaken Muslim societies. And that may seem strange to you, but that is a very pervasive view all over the region. So Israel oil and weakening Muslim societies to promote American goals are seen to be about 75% of people in several recent credible polls run by Americans in the region and the Arab countries has shown that. So there is a very strong sense that oil is one of the important goals in this region. I mean, what's peculiar about this foreign military intervention, the Americans and the British are the two leading proponents of this, is that this is done usually without really consulting the local people, asking what the natives want. So I think there's a very strong sense that American military intervention using the Marines is not the best way to bring about the kind of stability and security and promote your own national interest. That a better way to do this is to work with the people of the region for a transformation that suits their priorities and their timescales and their values. And this is something that peculiarly hasn't been done. You haven't had a serious engagement between the American government and people and the Arab people. You've had Arab governments. I mean, you talk to Hosni Mubarak and you talk to Zain al-Abidin bin Ali and you talk to Ali Abdullah Saleh, but these guys don't really represent their people. So there's a huge disconnect between the sentiments of the populations of the region and the strategic goals of the American military, and that disconnect really has to be figured out. Otherwise, Osama bin Laden and Donald Rumsfeld are going to be the guys who are going to continue pushing us into the cycle of death.
Well, thank you all, as always, for this edition of this conversation, which will be continuing, of course, for a long time to come. Rami Khoury, editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, and Mansour Farhang, formerly ambassador to the UN from Iran, now at Bennington College. Juan Cole, professor at the University of Michigan, a publisher of juancole.com. Jeff Beals, our diplomat, political advisor at the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, and our earlier guest, Edward Wong, staff writer for the New York Times in Baghdad. Dubai Ports World has formally asked the Bush administration for a 45-day investigation of its plans to take over management of some terminals at six American ports. Last week, the White House said that was unnecessary. Today, it welcomed the latest proposal. The New York Times says that will leave President Bush himself in the politically delicate position of having to personally approve or disapprove of the deal. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Herman Alnibak with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Republicans are among the harshest critics of the Dubai port deal. Democrats see it as a chance to outflank the president on the issue of national security. Others say the real issue is not who operates the ports, but how safe they really are. Gary Hart was Colorado's Democratic senator for 12 years. Before September 11th, he chaired the U.S. Commission on National Security. He's now author of a new book, The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. Senator, good to have you back on our program.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
I'll talk about security in a moment. First, the politics. Has the president now taken it upon himself to either approve or disapprove of a deal that nobody seems to like, but which he thinks is, and has said he thinks, is essential in this age of the globalized economy?
It seems that's what this deferral means, that the buck will ultimately stop on his desk. But this is in keeping with the style of the presidency up to now, which has been unilateral.
Is it appropriate, though, that he ultimately has to make this decision, especially given the political furor over it?
Well, given the fact that it was in large part his administration that caused the furor, I think it is appropriate. Normally, this would be decided by the Committee on Foreign Investment, which was established to depoliticize and make more objective and economical or financial these decisions rather than political, but it has become political. And I think it's really a symbol more than a metaphor for the confluence of the age of terrorism with the age of globalization.
Let me ask you this. Regardless of what the financial issues might be with the Dubai-owned company taking over management of some terminals at the ports, is that really an issue that's relevant to security directly?
I think it is, but it's a question of the magnitude of the issue. Given the fact of our dangerous reliance on oil supplies from the Persian Gulf, in comparison, this is a relatively small issue. As Steve Flynn said last night on 60 Minutes, the overall vulnerability of our ports leaving Dubai, and this issue aside, is the principal issue here. Even if Dubai is denied this contract, our ports are enormously vulnerable. So we can't, I think there is this tendency of the kind of issue of the day to overwhelm the larger issues, which include reliance on foreign supplies of oil generally and the vulnerability of our ports specifically.
How vulnerable are the ports? To what extent does that have to do with foreign management of the terminals, which, as I understand, is more often the case than it is not?
Well, exactly. And I think the management contracts are a subset of much larger vulnerabilities having to do with quantity, as Commander Flynn has pointed out on many occasions. And he was, by the way, an advisor to the U.S. Commission on National Security and caused us to focus on both terrorism generally and the ports particularly. And he was executive director of the follow-on study done by Senator Rudman and myself and others a year after 9/11. So he's as current on this issue as anyone. And he's essentially pointed out the quantitative problem of we're inspecting fewer than 5% of all cargo containers coming into the country, which means that in theory, at least 95 plus could contain, of 24,000 a day, could contain biological, chemical, or nuclear weapon.
That obviously is the great threat, particularly the possibility of a nuclear weapon. Is that made any greater or lesser a threat depending on who manages the terminals, what company owned by whom?
I think you'd have to be an expert in port security, which I do not claim to be, to get into those kind of details. I think the broader concern that others have pointed out isn't the kind of day-to-day management. It's access that employees of the Dubai port world would have to the blueprints of the port, to flow of traffic, to vulnerabilities. Now, let's suppose everybody currently working for Dubai Port World is pro-Western, anti-terrorist, and so on. This is not to say that in 6 months, two or three people or one person could apply for a position and make his or her way into one of those six ports and be, in effect, an al-Qaeda spy.
What about the way that this has been handled? Is the secrecy involved with the decision? Is that, do you think, the biggest mistake?
Well, politically, certainly. And the fact that apparently the president didn't know, or it's unclear whether he knew, certainly the congressional leadership, particularly on the Republican side, did not know. And so the idea of fait accompli decision-making has a tendency to blow up when it's as sensitive as this. And I think those involved certainly had their political radar turned off when they were deliberating on this issue, and they sort of decided among themselves, this was a solid company and a good company, and we don't we need to bother with lowly members of Congress.
Less than a minute left. With all your experience in Washington, how do you think this is ultimately going to be resolved or worked out?
I think they'll work out some sort of compromise between the White House, or among the White House and the two houses of Congress, the Republican leadership, and it will be a resolution of approval will be introduced, and it'll pass basically along party lines with some Republican defection, and depending on the size of that defection, it could be defeated. I think what's really also behind the scenes here is the sense, given the intensity of the president's reaction, that maybe something else is going on here, and I think we have quite a number of covert operations in Dubai that we don't want to disclose.
Senator Gary Hart, the shield and the cloak, the security of the commons, thanks a lot for being with us.
Great pleasure.
I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.